The Conservatives are the largest party. They don't have an overall majority at this stage. The Prime Minister called this election because she wanted certainty and stability. This doesn't seem to look like certainty and stability.
Welcome to Polling Politics. This week's podcast is sponsored by Ladbrokes Political Betting. I'm Joe Twyman, co-founder of Delta Poll.
And I'm freelance political journalist Marie Leconte.
Joining us this week is actor, campaigner and semi-professional footballer Rav Little. Hello.
Hello. I like that intro, thanks.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure.
I'm always happy when people mention football in any... So I'm like, yes, let's not forget that, the most important thing of my life.
Well, which is good because it leads on to our first thing this week. And it's inevitable on a podcast where we discuss politics and statistics around it that we have to begin with the fact that it's clearly coming home.
Oh, it's so coming home. It's pretty much on the way. It's already on the train.
It's virtually here.
Except it's not. Yeah, it's on the train, except it's booked the wrong ticket and it might sort of get diverted. But it feels euphoric today, right?
I agree. I didn't want to get too excited. And as I sat there during the penalty shootout last night, I thought, it's really important not to get too excited. And then when we won, I thought, no, this for me is confirmation.
It is coming home.
Up until last night, we'd won as many penalty shootouts as we'd won World Cups.
Yes.
Now, in stats, of course, that's a very strong correlation.
Yes.
Now we've won two.
Yes. Which was the previous World Cup penalty shootout we won? Was it like Mexico?
No, the previous one was the European Championships.
We've never won a World Cup penalty shootout.
So there we go. Yet further evidence.
Can I just say, I feel like there's something I need to admit and come clean. It's quite big, but I didn't actually get what "it's coming home" refers to. I've heard it a lot, and I feel like, you know, I've nodded a lot, and I'm very happy for you.
Well, of course you don't, because you're both French and essentially a child, so you don't remember 1996 because you were just born.
So I remember 98 when, you know, we
in France 98. Yeah, there you go.
I broke the couch in our holiday home, and so
here we go. So this was a song released for Euro 96.
Okay.
And it just.
Is that tune? I didn't know what the tune was.
Football's coming home. And it just caught wildfire. And then Euro 96, we got to the semis and we thought we were going to win. And then Germany beat us in a penalty shootout. And it's just...
Oh. Okay.
There you go.
That's quite catchy.
I'm going to fade that out now.
Yeah. So yeah, in Euro 96, it became the anthem, the whole country's anthem.
But then it did not come home.
And then they re-released it for France 98 and it equally did not come home. It's the
Football's
been lost for a long time, but now we feel like it might be coming home.
I'm actually controversially, like, I want you guys to win. I do not want France to win.
Wow.
But you know, I don't mind who wins as long as it's not France. Because Macron, when he met with the French team, said, "Bring me back the cup." Not "bring France back the cup" or "us, me."
Wow.
And I do not want to give Macron that satisfaction, because that's a
mad thing.
It's a
pretty niche objection in the grand scheme of things. But I'll take it.
I want Belgium to win, but you can go to the final.
Why Belgium?
Well, because I'm going to move to Brussels at some point. They're quite nice, you know, and also because Brexit, you know, we live in the banter era of politics, and it would be very funny for Belgium to win the World Cup.
And beating England in the final, which is still a possibility.
Yeah, no, that would be very funny. I'm sorry.
I'd kind of laugh at that as well, to be fair. I don't think that's an unreasonable statement.
One of the things you hear a lot about World Cup victories for England is that they bring about political change. One often quoted statistic is that England's victory in the 1966 World Cup final led to Harold Wilson's victory in the general election of 1966 because England wore red in the match. That's mentioned quite a lot. It was mentioned by, I believe, by my A-level politics teacher. The only problem with that is that the general election was in March and the World Cup was in July. But, you know, apart from
we got Theresa May landslide, another election, and then Vince Cable somehow become Prime Minister. I don't know.
I mean, strange things can happen, Marie, but I think Vince Cable becoming Prime Minister is significantly less likely than England winning the World Cup.
Which seems, the idea of anything being less likely than England winning the World Cup was an alien concept 4 weeks ago, but hey.
And that leads us on to, nicely, to things that no one can quite imagine happening. We're famous for our links on this show. Brexit. Brexit for me...
That was worse than the usual segue.
I know, I'm trying. I'm really struggling with that. But Brexit for me is turning into like a claw machine at a seaside resort, in that there's this claw reaching in to grab something. You don't really know what it is. It might drop it on the way. It might never get there. And when it arrives, it's probably going to be disappointing anyway. And that's where we find ourselves. The Prime Minister is apparently preparing to plan for the softest possible Brexit in her discussions with the Cabinet at Chequers on Friday. Now, Friday, of course, clashes with the Belgian match. I'm curious as to whether they'll stay on at Chequers to all watch the Sweden-England match together as one cabinet on Saturday.
Can you imagine a worse gathering to watch the football with? Would you want to be there?
I feel like the idea of Michael Gove in pyjamas is weirdly upsetting. I can't put my finger on why it's upsetting.
I'm not sure why it's weirdly upsetting. I think it's universally upsetting. Yeah. Upsetting.
I mean, Michael Gove just in general is upsetting. Pyjamas is just a horrific icing on a horrific cake.
Oh, well, we might come back to that later.
Oh, okay. Why are you winking at Marie for?
I have nothing
really
to do with this.
Horribly salacious manner.
Nothing to do with this. I don't know why.
So you've just found out she's French and you're like, haha, I'm going to go back to some sort of weird 1940s vibe.
You're French.
But to come back briefly, sorry, on Brexit, I think that, you know, and it's something I bang on about quite a lot, but I find it fascinating how much the Overton window has shifted when Downing Street is sort of like apparently briefing, saying, you know, the softest possible Brexit, when it's not that soft, you know, it's not staying in the customs union, it's not staying in the single market, it's effectively just having customs alignment, as far as I can tell, for goods, not services. And like, that's not the softest possible Brexit. That's actually like a year and a half ago, we would have still called that a hard Brexit. So I think the work the hard Brexiters have done to kind of, yeah, shift that Overton window has been incredible.
So the quote that it's the softest possible Brexit, which comes from Robert Peston's reporting, do you think what he actually means is it's the softest possible Brexit that hardcore Brexiteers will support in a cabinet discussion on a Friday at Chequers?
I don't fully get what, because the hard Brexiters effectively keep saying no to everything, but they've not really given anything, you know, besides no deal. So I'm not sure what they want. You know, it's kind of like the people on holiday going, I don't want to do this or that. But also, I'm not going to tell you what I want to do.
Oh, yeah. You've just described my girlfriend, basically, who's American. So she comes over here and says, she's like, can we do something today? I'm like, sure, what do you want to do? Anything? She's like, no, I don't mind. Anything, I'll do anything. Or I'll watch anything on TV that you want. And I'll go, okay, what about Family Guy? No, I don't want to watch that. You can't. And then she'll be like, I have no opinion.
What's the Brexit equivalent of Family Guy? You've actually led me on beautifully to my next link.
Another segue.
Speaking of people that we largely ignore but make some people laugh, Neil Hamilton from the 1990s has been effusive in his support of new UKIP members. So we've in the last week had a series of people from the alt-right join up to UKIP, ostensibly to take it over as part of a coup, or maybe just for fun, or perhaps both. But they include Milo Yiannopoulos, the professional internet troll, Paul Joseph Watson, the conspiracy theorist from InfoWars, Carl Benjamin, who posts videos on YouTube as Sargon of Akkad, not even sure if I'm pronouncing that right, and Mark Meechan, who's on YouTube as Count Dunkula and taught his dog to do a Nazi salute. That, ladies and gentlemen, is the future of UKIP as far as they are concerned. And Neil Hamilton is very happy. Marina Hyde from The Guardian described them as Crosby, Stills, Nash and Himmler.
I like in your description of them all, you went Milo Yiannopoulos, whatever he's called, and you said professional internet troll, and then found a different way to describe all the others, but yeah, professional internet troll is all of them.
You're right. Yeah. They are there for that purpose. But no Katie Hopkins. I noticed.
Snubbed.
Who would have thought
that a load of fascists also happen to be misogynists too? Isn't that weird?
Who can speculate as to why they rejected Katie Hopkins?
One anecdote and one thing. The first one being that someone pointed out on Twitter ages ago that you can sing Neil and Christine Hamilton to the tune of Alexander Hamilton.
Nice.
And it's horrible because I cannot hear those names again without thinking of that. And the second one is that
neither will I,
back in 2014, I crashed Milo's birthday party in London back when he was just a London troll. And he then found out that I was there and emailed my editor the next day to talk about like his staff who like crash my drinks, drink my free alcohol and then make fun of me on the internet. which is really pathetic. So that's my Milo anecdote.
How did you know about his birthday party and how did you crash it? Was it just in
Because a
friend
of mine had a long time ago interned for him back when he was just like a prick and had gone full
And that's, ladies and gentlemen, is how we were banned from iTunes.
Am I allowed to say?
I don't know, I was wondering when I sat down, I was like, no one's talked to me about like what language we're about allowed
we've
to
not
use.
Talked about
but
it.
I love that we started with he was just a prick and hadn't gone full. It's amazing.
Are we allowed?
I think on the swearing scale, I think probably shit, wanker and allowed, but will probably get beeped out. I'm interested to know what his birthday party was like. What happens at a Milo birthday party?
Let me tell you. So it was extremely racist because the theme was, I think, like ghetto lux or something. So there was free cosmopolitans and fried chicken. There were also canvases, like paintings of himself everywhere. So we stole one of them. Then there was a game among London journalists where we just send it by post to different people for their birthdays, and it just went around the London media for quite a while.
How big are these canvas paintings of Milo?
Like, quite big. We had like, quite a hard time stealing it.
Are they life size? Amazing image of Milo's wall being occupied by a series of life-size canvas paintings of him.
It was not quite life-size, but they were quite big and everywhere in the room.
I have a question about that lot, though. Milo and all those guys you just mentioned.
Prison Planet and Count Duncula.
Paul Joseph Watson, all that. Like, do we think, maybe each individual is different, but do we think that they believe the shit that they say? Or do we think that they've just absolutely gone, there's a market here, and like an Alex Jones type, there's a market here and I'm going to make money off it. And it's incredibly cynically they've made careers out of it.
I think the same way about this as I do about astrologers. Years and years and years ago, I worked with someone who worked with a famous astrologer who I won't name. I said to him, does he believe it? And his response was, he believes it makes him money.
Right.
And yeah. I feel it's probably the same way with these guys, that there's parts they believe, there's other parts they're not so down on, but they believe it makes them money, they believe it gets them followers, they believe it gets them influence, and so they follow that line.
I mean, you know, the incentives are clear for everyone to see, so you know, if it's just a cynical thing, then the equation, you know, balances out perfectly well. It's a dangerous world.
I think some of the beliefs were clearly already there. Well, you know, like they seem very comfortable with being racist and being sexist and everything. So that's clearly, I think, always been a part of their personalities. But I do definitely think that most of them just ramp it up for the fun, for the kind of like trolling and that Reddit culture of like, you know, triggering people because isn't it fun? Yeah, so I think it's part cynicism, but also rooted in stuff they do actually believe in to an extent.
When people go, oh, I'm just a provocateur, you know, I just like to press people. It's like, no, you're a dick. What you're doing is being a dick.
Yeah,
now fuck off before you become full. This is all your fault, by the way. Not me.
I'd like to apologise to our listener. My mum's going to be very upset.
Yeah, exactly.
We're going to lose our only subscriber.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to lose our only subscriber. She's going to say, I'm sorry, Joe, I was willing to put up with Julie Hardy-Brewer, but my goodness, that Ralph Little has a potty mouth. Noted grime fan and Secretary of State for Digital Culture, Media and Sport, Matthew Hancock, has started parkour, which if you're not familiar is free running, or as we used to call it when I was young, playing outside.
climbing
on trees, things, yeah. Jumping from one thing to another. He's posted this on his Twitter feed. Marie, have you taken a look at this?
I did. So I watched it. I was working from home when it came out, and I was just in the garden working, and I saw that, and I laughed so loudly. My housemate came from inside the house and was like, what the fuck have you been watching? But no, so what I love about this video is, I mean, okay, I'm going to make a list of things I like about this video. A, the fact that he's jumping from a sort of like very, very low platform. There is no risk at all. He's just jumping over a ledge.
Which is an interesting metaphor for British politics generally.
And that, you know, it was put in slow-mo and everything. But also then, I think we don't talk enough about the short interview after that. Is like, you know, the great thing is that you really get to learn about your body. It's like, what do you mean by that, Matt? And also the fact that there was no message at the end. You know, there was no, and this is why kids should do more exercise. This is why you should go outside. It was just, here's this sick video of me doing some tricks.
Want to see a 39-year-old jump on a wall? Yeah. Now's your chance.
That was it. Like, there was no point to it.
I might have to do one now. Maybe we should all go out after this and do our own parkour, our parkour videos and post them.
It's what the people have been waiting for.
It'll certainly cheer them up at Chequers while they're just thrashing out a soft Brexit.
I love the idea of all of them having this incredibly tense meeting and then just like Matt Hancock, like a cat, you know, in the room jumping from couch to couch.
Yeah. Like, Matt, what are you doing? He's like, oh, it's just, I'm really learning about my body.
It's called the cat jump. Get off the sofa, Matt. Get off the sofa. We need to discuss the softest possible Brexit. Ralph, you're famous for many things, including going to the same school as Ian McKellen and noted chess genius Nigel Short.
Not at the same time.
No. I imagine that must have been a hell of a class with three of you in it.
Yeah.
But you're also well known, certainly on the Daily Mail website, for your argument with Jeremy Hunt, accusing him of knowingly lying on Twitter, behaviour that the Daily Mail commenter described as typical of Ralph Little. Which I thought was a bit of an odd thing to say.
Yes.
But that
being the first time it had ever happened.
Yes. Yeah.
What does that mean?
I long ago stopped trying to work out what the comments on the Daily Mail website meant. But the NHS, obviously, this week is 70 years old, celebrating its birthday and the age at which so many people, of course, start needing the NHS. We've discussed previously on the podcast some of the stats surrounding this, the fact that nearly 9 out of 10 people are concerned with the way the NHS is funded, including over 8 out of 10 Conservatives, the fact that 2/3 of people support an increase in income tax or national insurance in order to pay for the NHS, and the fact that it's way ahead of the economy in terms of the most important issue other than Brexit. Where do you think we are with the NHS now?
The problem is, I was trying not to get Conservative Labour about this issue because I think it's bigger than either. And
actually, if you look at the stats, there's not that much difference in terms of support or opposition
I was at a march last Saturday. I'd made a speech at a march and, you know, just joining in with all the chants. And, you know, it's one of the chants that I specifically wouldn't join in with was, you know, what do we want Tories out? When do we want it now? Because wherever my allegiances lie, I don't think that that's necessarily the bigger issue. I think it should transcend party politics, as you say, the stats kind of reflect. So I think that there's this idea that, quote, the Tories have been trying to kill the NHS, and that's not an unfair thing to say, but I think you've got to be very careful about saying that there's this ideological, evil kind of drive to end something that's like a beautiful thing that we have in our society. So I try and avoid that. But, so that said, some people would argue, oh, the Tories have been trying to kill it for years. But I certainly think that, you know, the austerity myth, the fact that, you know, we had the economic crisis and the Tories have battled it by imposing austerity upon us despite the vast consensus of economists going, that's not the way to do it. In fact, if anything, you need to encourage people to spend. You know, whether or not, again, it was what we were talking about with Prison Planet and all those guys, do they believe what they're doing, or do they believe it on some measure, but they ramp it up for their own gain? I don't know, but it's a combination of austerity. It's been defunded since 2010. And all the time, and the reason I got involved is that whilst all this has been happening, Jeremy Hunt's been going on to every radio show, TV show going, what's actually happened is that I'm brilliant and the NHS is doing really well, and we've added this many percentage of new nurses and we've added this amount of spending, and it's just bullshit. So I got involved because I was, not for any other reason, I was just sick of looking at politicians lying after the whole Brexit thing had got me angry anyway. And then I saw Jeremy Hunt going online about the NHS. So I don't know. What was your question again?
NHS, good or bad?
You know, austerity has been the problem, and defunding, and, you know, the scary conspiracy theory version of it is, has it been defunded so that it can then be decried and then be taught, spun to the public like it's failing, and then go, oh, the only answer is privatisation. And then who's
do you
poised?
Think, do you think that's the game that at least some people in the Conservative
what's
Party
worrying
are playing,
about
or is that too conspiratorial?
What's worrying about Jeremy Hunt is that he wrote a book saying that, that a privatisation model would be healthy for the health service before he became Secretary of State for Health. That's a worrying signal. That said, I do believe people can and should be allowed to change their mind, even in politics. I think you can go, I don't stand by that anymore. I said things 3 years ago that I don't stand by on Twitter, or 10 years, I think things change. And I think this whole thing where we've got with politicians, you go, hold on a second, that's not what you said. Well, okay, I got more information, I changed my mind. I think people should be allowed to do that, but it's worrying. And I think it's our job, it's our duty, the public and journalists, to keep politics, obviously to keep them honest, but on that particular score, to keep him honest about going, can you be certain that you're not going to privatise this? There is money. There's money in the system. There's money in the system going to Virgin, you know, Virgin Healthcare. And every time someone like that, every time Virgin Healthcare suing the NHS successfully, you know, that this is where the problems lie. I don't know what the answer is, but the big battle is against privatisation, I think. That's what...
But do you not think, and I think this is something we briefly talked about, like, not here, but what I find really interesting is that weird kind of, like, emotional side that British people have, so, like, towards the NHS. And again, I think, you know, the kind of happy birthday NHS thing is proving that as well. It's not just saying, you know, yeah, hey, you know, we've had that for 70 years, cool, well done us. Like, is this active? So, again, very emotional, feels like, you know, the birthday of a relative. And I don't know, from an outsider's perspective, and even, you know, as someone who very strongly is in favour of, you know, universal free healthcare, I don't really get it. And I wonder if it's actually not harming the debate as well to actually have this kind of sense of, you know, we can't really say anything negative about the NHS, and, you know, it's our NHS and we love it. And is that really the healthiest way to talk about a public service and how actually we can make it better?
You mean that we've lost objectivity in a certain respect?
I do think so. And I think that, again, you know, some people who can make, I think, decent enough points about how the NHS is, you know, failing, let's say, on X and Y, and we can make it better, even if those people come from a space of, you know, being very pro the NHS, people will just go, well, you know, when my nan got ill, actually, yeah, they were great, therefore the NHS is great. And it's like, but that's not the issue. These are different things.
Well, or worse, is the people, NHS naysayers, of which there are, you know, some, they all apparently follow me on Twitter, you know, going, yeah, well, you know what, my nan went in with a bad toe and never left because the NHS killed her and they were understanding it. It's like, yeah, but your personal anecdote and story and emotional experience of the NHS is not what the NHS is and needs to be, and that doesn't help, like you say, the objective discussion. You tweeted out, Marie, about what's with the British emotional response to the NHS. Did you get any responses that just kind of shed light on it?
Yes and no. I think there are a few interesting points. I think the first one is the fact that the British have always had quite a complicated history, like, relationship with the state. And the NHS is actually one of those few things where actually the vast majority of people are like, yeah, no, fine, that's good. B, the fact that it's free at point of use. So, you know, in France, it's not like then you do have stuff that, you know, they'll pay you back and it's a bit of a nightmare. So I think there's that. I think there's the, you know, that thing of the UK thinking that the only two countries in the world are the UK and the US. So when they look at the NHS, they're like, well, it's either that or like horrible healthcare like the yeah. US, not thinking about the fact that actually most countries in the EU have, you know, so like free universal healthcare. I think these are the three main
I actually think that's quite a big issue, the UK-US thing. I really do, because I mean, the comparison is, I mean, it's such an easy comparison. You go, well, what we've got is amazing, what they've got is absolutely dreadful. But it doesn't allow for any discussion of what's in. I don't really know what the system is in France. I don't, you know, but France, Germany seems to be, you know, they're not all dying by the millions. So they've obviously got a health service that works, you know, like what. And I don't think, even truthfully, I don't think I really know what their systems are. So we do definitely have this emotional idea of this system is the best possible system.
Well, a lot of it is linked to the problem, if you want to characterise it as a problem, that it is the closest we have to a secular religion in this country. And so the downside of that is that anyone who criticises it is accused of the equivalent of blasphemy. And that criticism can be very light and it can be very constructive. But because it's criticism, it still creates an issue and people switch off. When you ask the public, should more money be spent? Could more be done? They say yes, but then that's almost inevitable that they should think more money should be spent because people still die.
Yeah.
And equally, if you ask
the public or plenty of individuals in the public, okay, cool, can we up your tax by this? They'll go, whoa, hey, hold on, no.
Well, that's actually one of the things that has been asked. A penny on income tax for extra NHS spending, 54% of people support that. 62% support an increase in national insurance from 12% to 13%. And the difference between those two results is presumably down to the fact that most people don't understand what national insurance is.
Well, yeah.
I think, well, that's how, yeah.
Yeah, that's fine.
Fine.
Probably increase that.
I think also the fact that it feels constantly under attack one way or the other. I think that probably has boosted the... So post-war Labour government, Nye Bevin set it up, and it was like, okay, war, it's been terrible. You know what? It's about time that we did something to be progressive. So there was that kind of optimism surrounding it, I suppose, for previous generations. And then I grew up feeling like it was always under attack. And I feel like it's under attack now. And I think that that doesn't help. I don't mean under attack from criticism, like you say, even light constructive criticism. Just mean like fundamentally the idea that people are going to try and privatise and try and line their pockets from it. You know, and they do. There are statistics about it being still in the world the most efficient and the most value for money healthcare system. So it's not just, it's not an emotional argument without some basis in reality either.
But isn't that also partly because the UK spends a lot less on healthcare than other countries do? So, like, it's good value for money in the sense that there's a lot less money being spent. It's like, I don't know, I feel like the weird thing, and I'm not saying this is true or right or whatever, like, you know, people are probably wrong, but in France, we think of the NHS as some, like, you know, like, basically, like, borderline third world, like, you know, do not get ill if you're in the UK. Wow. Like, when I moved to London, I remember my parents were like, look, if you get really ill, they're just like, tell us, we'll get you on a plane back to France. Like, don't basically go to the doctor. Like, for ages, I'd only get to the dentist and stuff when I was going back to France for my Christmas holidays, because they were like, we know the NHS is a lot worse than the French health system.
Wow.
And again, you know, not That's saying this is, like, factually correct. I'm not sure. Generally, I don't know. But also that from abroad, from the rest of Europe, there is that sense that actually healthcare in the UK is kind of crap.
Well, that's fascinating because... This goes back to what you said earlier. My American girlfriend is like, oh my God, it's incredible what you guys have got there. I can't believe it. And, you know, when I met her, she was over here last year and she was, I was in her play and she was working here and paying her taxes here, for anybody that happens to be listening to this and wants to get on Twitter going, why is she using the NHS if she's American? She was like, it's absolutely extraordinary. You know, you get an appointment within a couple of days and you can go and see. And so the Americans can't believe it, but how fascinating to hear that the French and other European countries are a bit like, yeah, it's a little bit ramshackle. I think nobody's saying that we don't need to spend more money on it. Everybody agrees that. I think probably if you think that statistically it still demonstrates the best value for money, perhaps then if you spend more money on it, you'll get still the best value for money, but a better system, which is a fairly sane argument, I think.
One would hope. Mm. Ralph, you were in Ugly Lies the Bone last year?
Yes, that was my American girlfriend's play, in fact.
Oh, right. Well, and very good it was too.
thank you very much.
I saw it at the National.
Did you really?
Yes, I did. I'm not saying that just for conversation. Yeah. But this does lead on to something.
Do you know what? I was just thinking, when you said I'm very good it was too, I was thinking, is he just saying that? And I was about to ask you what your favourite bit was, but just to try and trap you. which bit did you like?
The VR set. I thought the VR set really was very good. Unfortunately, I was quite far back, so I couldn't see the makeup of the main actress.
Yeah.
which I heard was very good as well.
Interesting, yeah.
But it dealt with the issue of post-traumatic stress and mental health. Do you think that mental health is a black spot for the NHS? Do you think it's an area where we could, as a country, do much better?
That was a leading question.
Yes. The answer is yes. Next.
I'm not always very balanced with my thing. I think this is an interesting thing to explore.
The statistics I particularly got angry with when I called out Jeremy Hunt on TV and called him a liar happened to be statistics about mental health provision. And there's been a slight conflation of people's view of what my expertise or interest is, in as far as I was calling out lies about the NHS. Now people are like, thank you for standing up for mental health. And I'm like, that's great, I am. But I don't really know a huge amount about it. So I've had to sort of, it's a horrible thing to go, I do care about that, but if I talk too much about that, then it'll start to become very obvious I don't really know that much about what I'm talking about. That said, what I have come to understand is that there really is, as I just said, a groundswell of people going, this is something that we really need to address. And things that when you were growing up, things like, oh, come on, pull yourself together. Oh, he's just a bit down. We've started to realise that actually these are mental health conditions. Mental health, even happiness, is a mental health condition, a positive mental health condition that can be, you know, that has a genetic proponent and can be medicalized, but there's whole sorts of philosophical questions about whether you can and all that kind of thing. The point is, yes, I think it's massively more in conversation than it used to be. And I think that it's a whole new area of medicine that's being explored in a way that's going to need money and care and attention and a political will to understand it. The fact that it's only just got parity of esteem with physical well-being is astonishing to me, but it makes a lot of sense.
But I think there's a kind of like societal changes happening as well, where there's been kind of two waves as I see it, of, you know, the first one kind of being, you know, we need to talk about stuff like, you know, depression and anxiety and the amount of people who suffer from it. But I think more recently there's been several, especially young, actually female voices, which has been really heartening, talking about, you know, okay, this is all great, but also when you talk about mental health, you do have to realise that we also talk about bipolar disorder, we talk about schizophrenia, stuff with symptoms that will make you uncomfortable. And there was actually a really good piece last week, I think, in The Guardian by Hannah Jewel Parkinson, who has lived with bipolar disorder all her life, and saying, actually, you know, this is not a thing that will get better by just talking about it, mm-hmm. or just by being open. My problem is that, you know, I will sort of, you know, have these symptoms which normal people, quote unquote, will find actually quite scary and quite terrifying. And, you know, and I've tried to commit suicide many times. I've spent a lot of time in psychiatric hospitals because I was not safe by myself. That change is happening at a society level of being like, okay, well, mental health is not just, you know, it's not just good enough to talk about it and, you know, occasionally take some meds. Like, there are so many different things people can suffer from.
Exactly what we were just saying about, there's this will to, within the medical fraternity, to start researching and go, this is actually a, I mean, obviously schizophrenia, bipolar, those are the kinds of things that medicine has already covered a lot of ground on. But I think the sociological will to say, actually, yes, we should talk about it, but also there needs to be more than that done as well. You know, there need to be beds and therapy and research, and people need to take this as a, like I say, parity of esteem with physical well-being. It is difficult. Even I've fallen foul of it over the years. I've fallen foul of not understanding, because when somebody breaks their leg, you can see that they have a broken leg, and you can see that broken leg needs to be fixed. When somebody's bipolar and can't get out of bed but they're physically okay, it's very difficult because you can't see that something needs to be fixed, or for want of a better word. But, you know, good, things are changing, I hope. I think, like you say, with sociologically, medically, and hopefully politically.
Joining us now for our weekly chat is Matt Shaddock from Ladbrokes Politics. Hello, Matt.
Hi, Joe.
Hi. We've been talking about the NHS and specifically Jeremy Hunt. I'm interested in him particularly because, taking a look at the betting for the next Conservative leader, Jeremy Hunt is number 5 on the list, with Michael Gove and Sajid Javid at the top. Has that market been moving around a lot?
Yeah, it has. I mean, Jeremy Hunt's interesting. I mean, about 6 months ago, you could have backed him at 50-1, 66-1 to be next leader. And people have gradually cottoned on to the fact that he's been in the cabinet, in big jobs for several years now. He probably hasn't made that many enemies. And within the Tory party, I think people think he's doing a reasonable job in a very difficult department. So, yeah, into 12-1 now, Hunt. He came in again this week. I think there were some reports in the papers over the weekend suggesting he was actually raising money and starting to organise things for a potential leadership bid whenever that happens. So, yeah, I think it's quite plausible these days.
Sajid Javid was mentioned by our guest Jess Phillips a few weeks ago. He seems to have been surging up the table as well. He's now joint favourite with Michael Gove. What's his movement been like?
Yeah, I mean, quite similar to Hunt. It wasn't that long ago he was a big price. He got the Home Office, which saw his odds collapse very quickly, and he's come in again this week. I think the Con Home poll this week had him actually winning among the Tory activists that they ask about that. Yeah, and again, he looks very, very well placed should there be a vacancy anytime soon.
Now, one of the things we know, of course, about Conservative leadership elections is that the favourites very rarely make it through. Looking down the list to people like Dominic Raab and perhaps even David Davis, who would you say is good for an outside bet on the list?
Yeah, Raab at 20-1, I think, is a fair price. He's a very good media performer. I mean, often these sorts of contests end up being won by quite a sort of fresh face who's perhaps not been around that long, or is maybe not that well known by the general public, so he fits the bill there. I mean, the other person I can see is always talked up by the sort of shrewdies and insiders is Tom Tugendhat, who never been in the cabinet, but is considered a very good performer and one for the future.
Speaking of fresh faces, down at the bottom you have, further down, you have people like Alan Mack at 125-1, Daniel Hannan at 150-1. What's the process that you go through to determine whether someone's 125 or 150-1?
It just depends on the amount of money we take. I mean, we take an initial guess, and then if people are backing them, they'll come in a bit. I mean, anyone who's bigger than 100-1, you could say, you know, we're very rarely going to be taking any money on these people. I mean, there are a few plausible ones here. Kemi Badenoch, she's another young MP who people often say is heading for the top. But for people like her, I think we need Theresa May to hang on for a bit longer before they can have the kind of profile which would enable them to win. I mean, you know, people like Mark Harper sometimes mentioned, Joe Johnson, you know, we've taken a few quid on him over the last few months. I mean, it's very, very plausible, in my opinion, that we could have a big outsider, but it's kind of difficult to know who that's going to be.
The last thing I wanted to ask was about football. This has obviously been something where we've been particularly interested in. How does the excitement over a national event such as the World Cup interact with betting on politics? Do people get excited about one thing and then move over to that?
I don't know about that. I mean, the interesting thing is I think there's been a little bit of work done on what happens to governments when their national sporting teams do very well. I think Stephen Bush wrote something about this morning. There does seem to be a small correlation. So, you know, if England were to get to the final or even win this tournament, wouldn't be that surprising if the Tory poll rating bumped up a little bit. But these things tend to be quite short-lived, I think.
OK, thank you, Matthew, and thank you to Ladbrokes Politics for sponsoring this week's podcast. Bananas in pyjamas are coming down the stairs. Bananas in pyjamas are coming down in pairs. Bananas in pyjamas. And finally then, pyjamas.
Sure. That's what I've been waiting to talk about.
Yeah, exactly, that's what you're here for. Campaigner, semi-professional footballer, and pyjama aficionado.
I knew we were doing all that NHS bollocks because we were leading to something important.
Do you think that pyjamas should be worn in bed?
Absolutely not.
Absolutely. So we have an absolutely not from Ralph.
Oh, no, Marie. Obviously not.
What do you think the percentage of Brits is for pyjama wearing? And that can be pyjamas and underwear. Or just pyjamas only.
Oh, right.
I'd say a really high number. You people are weird and like uncomfortable with nudity. So I'd say a really high number.
Not sure how comfortable I am with the phrase you people.
for British females, what do you think the figure is?
Oh, I'd say 40%.
67.
Wow.
67%.
See, fucking weirdo country. Just yeah. Jesus.
I have to agree. I agree.
Well, for men, 41%. For men, 41%. I completely agree. I think wearing pyjamas is actively wrong.
Yeah, whenever it's on TV, you see, you know, a couple in bed or on a film or whatever, and they're in the little pyjamas. I'm like, what couple doesn't sleep naked together? And apparently the answer is loads.
but at the same time on TV, you have those strange L-shaped sheets. That
But previous girlfriends, we'd start, stay over and why don't you bring move some clothes in and, you know, that kind of thing. You get to that point of the relationship and then it's like, okay. And then they get into bed and I'm going, what are you wearing? They're like, well, now that I've moved in, I'm just going to wear some pyjamas. I'm like, not if you want to stay here, you know? Take them off. And now we're on to domestic abuse. So so that brings me to my next issue.
In 10 years' time, when we're using this podcast as evidence.
Yes, yeah. No, I do.
The signs were there.
I find it utterly bizarre. I don't understand. I mean...
It never gets cold enough in this country. No. I could get it if it got properly cold.
Certainly the people who wear pyjamas in this weather, I think yeah. they have...
Psychopath, all yeah. murderers. Yeah, yeah, every yeah, single yeah, one
correct.
Of them.
Subhuman
murderer.
Scum. Subhuman scum. to quote Alan Partridge.
there is an age effect. As you get older, your likelihood of wearing pyjamas diminishes. Which I was really surprised.
So I think
Ralph, the answer is you should be going for older women.
How old though?
Over 65s. So it's 47% wear no pyjamas.
Oh, excellent! That's my demographic right there. there we go.
So there we go. And on that note, I think we're going to have to draw things to a close. All we have time for is a quick look at some of the tweets we've received. Look at that one. Hmm. Okay, and so thank you very much to our guest, Ralph Little. No time for our interview with Gareth Southgate again, unfortunately, but once he comes home, it'll all be fine.
With the trophy.
Exactly. Thank you very much, and we will speak to you all next week. Please remember to like, subscribe, review, all these different things that help people hear about us, and do tell all of your friends and many of the people that you don't know, even if you haven't enjoyed the podcast. This is a Poddo podcast produced by Nick Hilton, and our theme tune is by Joe Button.
For more details, go to podopods.com, and for sales and advertising, email nick@podopods.com.
And yes, that's spelled podopods.com.